Gautam opening the sutra.
The Dharma incomparably profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
Good morning, everyone. Today we're going to have a little Saturday matinee double feature. Those of you who remember that, used to be able to get two movies for like a buck, and now it's $8 and you only get one movie. But they used to have that, and it was a delightful thing on a rainy Saturday. The occasion of this little double talk, as it were, is that this is, I guess most of you know that we have going on this weekend, one of the Zen and Deep Ecology weekends, the Quiet Waters, and that we're kind of, well, not at the midpoint yet, but we're moving along in that. We've already had two paddles this weekend. And some other things, and there are these two talks that I prepared for that. They're both fairly short talks, and so we thought it would be good for possibly everybody to kind of hear the talks. And particularly, the first one kind of gives the explanation of what these are all about, and beginning this by talking about two terms that you may have seen if you looked at the brochures or the descriptions of this weekend and the other similar weekends, and those two terms are deep ecology and ego psychology. Deep ecology is a term coined by a Norwegian philosopher, Arne Naess. And because Arne Naess is a philosopher, his explanation is not simple, and mine is going to be, because I'm not a philosopher. Simply stated, the deep ecology perspective is one in which we shed our anthropocentric perspective, changing how we are interacting with the world around us. I believe that the anthropocentric perspective, I have to say that a lot of times in this talk, and it's not easy, where we believe that humans are somehow more special and deserving than other creatures on this planet, is responsible for all of the devastation of species, ecosystems, and climate that is occurring. The opposite of anthropocentricity is the egocentric perspective. It's much easier to say, so you can see why it's a better perspective right from the start, in which all creatures and their habitats and ecosystems are equally deserving of respect and care. At the moment I am writing this, I'm sitting in my backyard, accompanied by three squirrels, two types of woodpeckers, a chipmunk, a pair of blue jays, a cowbird, a tufted titmouse, a cardinal, a chickadee, and a wren. What wonderful neighbors to be sharing this July afternoon with. How can we see any of these creatures and their survival as less important than our own? And yet we do, because we believe that we humans are special and deserving. For much of my life, I was firmly embedded in that anthropocentric perspective, and I must confess that I have not always valued these delightful creatures. I dismissed the songbirds as Tweety birds. Perhaps they were not exciting or lacked any immediate utility. The squirrels and chipmunks were definitely too commonplace to be of any interest. Surrounded by beautiful music and delightful antics, I was simply deafened and blinded by my narrow mindset. But I was not that different than millions of other Americans in that regard. Today, if I drive by the mall on the most beautiful summer day as I head to the forest, pond, or ocean, I see the parking lot packed with cars. Our culture has taught us that material possessions are to be valued above all else. We are acculturated to believe that it doesn't matter whether we hear the birds or see the deer. What matters is whether we have a 72-inch plasma flat-screen television or whether we are dressed in the best and latest fashions. The second concept is that of eco-psychology. Increasingly, I'm seeing eco-psychology as the means by which we are able to accomplish the shift to a more open, eco-centric perspective. Dropping our preconceptions, our attachments, and our presumed needs, we are open to the wonderful reality that is before our eyes when we only look. As we become more intimate with this world, we realize that it is us. There is no hierarchy and no separation. When this happens, we fully experience the healing solace that this natural world has to offer us. Our psyche needs this balm for its stability in an ever-maddening world. Of course, as this relation grows, it is symbiotic. The more we enter into and are restored by the natural world, the more we seek to preserve and protect it. I can't say precisely when and how this shift to a more ecocentric awareness began for me. It came slowly over time. Undoubtedly, Zen, with its emphasis on direct experience, unconditioned by our conceptual structures, played a very significant part. That opening to deep connection with the world is the essence of this marriage of Zen with deep ecology. Now I would like to introduce a third concept, edge. In ecological terms, edge is where two ecosystems meet and merge. For example, where woods and open meadows meet. It is at the edge that the greatest species diversity exists. There is constant movement at the edge. Deer, wild turkeys, and other woodland species emerge to browse along the field. Woodchucks, fox, snakes, and mice all reside there. Songbirds from both forest and meadow fill the air with their music. This weekend, we are in the process of exploring the edge where land and water meet, the marshes and bogs along the edges of pond and stream. Unlike the middle of the pond or the depths of the woods, which can sometimes seem relatively devoid of life, at this edge, diverse creatures abound, surrounding us in every dimension. Water lilies, pickerel, and duckweed are everywhere. Dragonflies dart about while ospreys and eagles fly overhead. Otters, muskrats, herons, ducks, and loons surprise us at every meandering turn in the marsh. We are startled by the slap of a beaver's tail, yes we are, or the splash made by a large bass as we paddle by. Turtles slide silently into the water at our approach, while bullfrogs welcome us with their basso song. But we must also be ready to fully experience this. To do that, we must go to a different edge, that between the known and familiar world formed by our thoughts and conceptions, and the one where we are total strangers. In that world, there is no convenient organization with taxonomic nomenclature to make us at home. We must leave the forest of our convenient and comforting thoughts. There are not even us and them. Merging into the marsh, our separate identity slips away. We are the pulsing life around us. This experience of intimacy is what eco-psychology tells us can heal our civilization-ravaged lives. The process of this weekend is to open to experience this in a deep way. Through Zazen, outdoor walking and floating kinhin, silence and eco-psychology exercise, we're breaking down the walls of our conventional way of relating to the world and opening to each fresh new moment. So before I launch into the second part of this, I'll pause there and see if any folks have comments or questions or observations.
One thing that comes to my mind is that there are a lot of people, kids, who populate these malls, but I'm not absolutely convinced that all of them are necessarily consumers. I think this is another environment for people to move in, and it's familiar and it's got different things in it, but I'm not sure that every one of them is out to, you know, purchase. It's just, I kind of look on it as a different environment, as a city is. People who love to live in cities, but kind of get creeped out in the country.
It seems that makes sense to me, Deborah. But I guess I would argue or suggest that that's still a reflection of sort of disconnection from the natural world. If we would choose to go an air-conditioned, Muzak-laden shopping mall as our entertainment on a beautiful day, that is to some extent a reflection of our inability to relate to nature, to the world. And maybe people who, in the same way, I think that people who are kind of totally citified are it's very similar, you know. And just my opinion is that is missing a huge piece of life, but that it's also, you know, if you look at the incidence of mental illness in this country, for example, I mean, it's off the charts. Levels of things like depression and anxiety are extraordinarily high. And they're not the same in the third world nations, you know. And so part of my contention would be that a lot of that sort of malaise comes out of our ability to kind of be healed in a natural way.
I agree with you. It's the only reason I mentioned that was that it occurred to me that some of these people don't know anything else, and they need somebody to defend them. But I basically agree with what you're saying.
That's really true, what you're saying, I think. It strikes me always when some of my daughters visit, what they want to see is the mall. They want to go to the mall. What kind of a mall do you have? What's there? I said, we have beautiful country, we have woods and things like that. Oh, we want to go to the mall.
Well, it's the mall is outside ourselves, and it's something we can touch and feel and see. Whereas when we go out in the country, it's, you really have to go inside. At some point, you can't just wander around in the woods and not somehow become more introspective, I don't think.
And it's a question, when I lived on Long Island, you know, that's what you did. That's, you know, Friday night, my wife at that time and I, we went to the mall. We wandered, I mean, you know, and we didn't necessarily buy anything. You know, if we had money, we did. I mean, we were, you know, addicted to spending, so if we had, you know, but if we didn't have money, we just wandered around and I don't know what, ate a pretzel and had a drink or something, and look. But again, so I think you're right. I mean, I think it's what people in many senses are accustomed to if they live in urban or suburban areas.
When you said that you didn't remember when you started to notice the natural world, I started in New York City, which is, and you talked about the edge, that the edges, in a way, it was so surreal. New York City is an incredible place to go bird watching. I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, meet a couple other people in Central Park, and at 5 a.m. people are stumbling home from clubs, and some people are going to work. And this was such an incredible example of that there's this whole other world, you know, and people are walking right by it and can't see it. They can't see it and they can't hear it, and it's right there. There's birds mating and nesting and almost 300 species during the spring in Central Park, and people don't see it. But some people stumble into it. I did, because one day I saw a common flicker and I thought it escaped from somebody's cage. When I found out that it was a common bird in the Northeast, then I got my first copy of Peterson's Field Guide. It was like, that thing that kept me from being able to see and hear it just fell away. And you know, on my first day of suddenly seeing, I saw 20 birds. I was like drunk with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and well, you mentioned kids, my neighbor's kids. They think I'm very weird. But go into the woods and live on the edge of the town in the woods. And with their mom, they go to the mall a lot. But it's so, you know, even though they live in the country, there's kind of the only times I see them interacting with the country are on very noisy outdoor equipment. And with me, it's like, let's listen to the, look at that. And there are really magic moments, but so I think, somebody needs to introduce people. some of us wander in, but I just got lucky one day. But I grew up with people who said, my dad says, he's seen one tree, you've seen all.
That's a wonderful story about the birds. And does it also say something about how much more flexible the birds are than we are? I mean, they will put their nests wherever they can. Mm-hmm. We are not so flexible.
Yeah, when it is a wonderful story. And when Julie was talking, it made me think of Atlantis altissima, which is tree of heaven, and it grows through every crack in the concrete in the city. It can't be suppressed. As soon as the concrete breaks, up come these shoots, and so even the city-est city can't destroy completely that presence of nature.
Do you know the book that talks about what if suddenly human beings disappeared right in the blink of the eye, what would happen to the cities? And they use New York City as an example.
The World Without Us, I think it's called.
It's extraordinary. Not that I think that this should happen, but some people say, oh, it's such a depressing book, but the primalness of nature's power, in 3 hours, New York City would be flooded. I mean, the amount, I mean, and you can feel the places where it's being held back.
Well, I think that the holding back and the controlling, if you look at it from a historical context, you know, for a long time, people's lives were at the mercy of nature, the environment, and it's only recently that people have gained some degree of what they feel is control or stability in controlling their day-to-day environment. And to step away from that means giving up some control or giving up some sense of stability or comfort or something, and that's not easy if you're just used to that all the time and you live in a very controlled environment, which most people in this country do for the most part. I don't know what it is. It's horrifying to me that there are now active programs to help kids who are afraid of being outdoors and have them spend time outdoors so that they're not freaked out by it. It's just, you know, but that's the effect of where our industrial society has gone to by this effort to control our daily lives and get some stability. Now we have to reintroduce ourselves. It's very odd.
Now, my parents were New Yorkers, and as was I at one point. When I was living on a farm in Vermont, they would come and visit me, and they were very open to nature. They loved gardening, they loved birds, all those things. But they wouldn't go out at night because there were no streetlights. You know, they were just so accustomed that you had to have some, you know, it never gets dark in the cities, it's always light. And, you know, when they saw real darkness, that was terrifying. Okay. So, some of you recently heard Steph give a wonderful little impromptu talk about a great white shark, which he had learned about from Peter Harris. And Steph talked about the great power of loving kindness as manifested by the fishing person. Has everybody here heard the story before I repeat it ad nauseum? No. Oh, good. Okay. So, I too want to use that as the basis for a talk, but today I want to focus on the actions of the shark rather than that of the fisherman. I'm sure you recognize that as the ominous sound heralding the approach of the monster Jaws. Most of us remember the summer of 1975 when, courtesy of Steven Spielberg, Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider saved the people of peaceful Amity Island from a rampaging great white who was devouring swimmers, sailors, boats, and everything in sight. And we were collectively afraid to go back in the water. The interest in great whites spawned by the film brought expert after expert before the TV cameras, telling us about this great monster of the deep, this killing machine, this horrific creature that we thought only existed in our nightmares and on Hollywood backlots. Now, from these experts, we know certain things about sharks, particularly great whites. They are ancient creatures with primitive brains. They live purely by instinct, lacking the capacity for thought and have no emotions. So how do we explain the behavior of this shark towards the fisherman? It could appear that the shark is displaying affection and gratitude, two complex feelings. Furthermore, we could ask, how could the shark comprehend the significance of being stuck in a net, which is seeming its seeming affection and gratitude towards the fisherman applies? After all, a primitive creature wouldn't understand the threat to its own mortality. It has no concept of self or mortality. If it was caught, it would simply struggle blindly, driven by pure instinct. And once released, it would promptly return to its normal function as a killing machine. I think that we can conclude either of two things from this story. First, and most likely, is that Peter Harris's retelling was inaccurate in one crucial detail. This was not a great white shark, but rather a great white Shrek, a little-known relative of the lovable green ogre in the Disney Pixar film of the same name. That would most certainly explain the phenomenon. The other, far less plausible explanation is that our understanding of the behavior and of an intellect of sharks and perhaps of all other creatures is erroneous. That would, of course, be very contrary to a very basic anthropocentric assumption that we are it. After all, it, the very pinnacle of evolution or creation, depending on your viewpoint. Whether we believe that the process was a series of accidents that took billions of years or a deliberate activity that took 7 days, the result is clear. We humans alone possess rational self-consciousness, which along with our ability to manipulate the environment gives us the dominion over all other creatures. We are special, unique, and important. And yet new evidence continues to appear, challenging those and many other assumptions. Bacteria appear to display intelligent communal organization. Dolphin behavior is seen transforming simultaneously across the globe as one of many phenomena that suggest the presence of morphogenic fields, vast interconnected templates of existence. Physics now suggests that consciousness is a property of matter, not a function of the brain. Of course, Buddhism has for 2,500 years brought practitioners to experience a different perspective on reality, that of the one body. As we experience that one body, we see that each and every phenomenon lacks an individual existence. Each being is simply a manifestation of the whole. Each and every being is deeply and intimately connected. Therefore, we begin to see consciousness differently, for it is not our consciousness, and even this too does not exist as a distinct and separate thing. When we see this, we realize that all the distinctions are not real. We are not separate from anything else. We are no different from anything else. We are insubstantial, transient manifestations of the one body, and that's all. We are nothing special. So for us as Buddhists, the idea that all matter is conscious is not surprising at all. Neither is the possible existence of unifying fields shaping transformation across the planet and perhaps the universe. We open to all possibilities. At the same time as we realize the one body, we see that there is absolutely no support for the anthropocentric view. Once we take that narrow lens away, the idea that a shark can have feelings becomes entirely possible. We are not proprietors of a vast biological reserve. We are co-participants in the great dance of life. That dance is going on constantly all around us. All we have to do is slow down and let go of our fixed ideas and perceptions. For the past several weeks, I've had a mother spider guarding her nest on the gunwale of my canoe. She has remained there, clinging doggedly to the egg cluster as I have driven the canoe on my cart to Belfast, to Arcadia, and to Moosehead. She has barely moved as I have paddled around several ponds. She has kept up her vigil through torrential rains of the past few weeks. And as I write this, she is still there. She's not there today. So much time has passed that I doubt her young will appear, yet she perseveres. Is that pure instinct, blindly driving her to her own demise? Or is there more? Could this be the determination of a mother who is devoted to her offspring and who is doggedly clinging to any chance that they may emerge, even if it costs her life? We may never know that answer, but it seems as if we should open our eyes and ask the question.
Yeah, I was very pleased last week at Boy Scout camp to see over the course of the week, transition in the boys in our troop from, oh, there's a spider, let's kill it, to, after me saving several insects from assassination attempts, by the end of the week, they would bring the bugs to me and say, look what I found, and then put it back down on the ground. I said, yes. They don't instantly think, let's kill it anymore. Maybe they do now, because I'm not around, but it was interesting.
Did anyone here read or see the article in the last week's New York Times Magazine, Watching Whales Watching Us? We still have that, right?
Yeah. What? In fact, I printed it today.
Uh-huh. A copy will be given to you. It is amazing. I mean, it's the whales are watching the human beings in Baja Bay, which is their breeding grounds. And it's, you'll have to read it. It's really fascinating.
I used to be interested in scuba diving a lot, and. And when I was a teenager, I was obsessed about it. I'd read everything I could about scuba diving, and they'd talk about all the wildlife that you were supposed to be careful with. And then they'd get to orcas, and it was like, they want to kill you. They just want to kill you. That's all they want to do. And, it was all that time since. Lo and I were up in Newfoundland, but 4 years ago, and we got the scoop on a really neat whale watch, and we ended up going out on a Zodiac, and we saw lots of nifty whales. But then we got, look over there, and we zoomed over there, and there was a pod of orcas, and the females and the juveniles were swimming around us. They were curious. We were just sitting there floating, and they were coming in and checking us out. I have video, just shot with a video camera, just shooting over the water. And this is a Zodiac. I mean, this isn't a big iron boat. So, I mean, you're pretty damn close to the water. And I can see the white on the side of the orca under the water, just swimming around the boat. And then there was a big alpha male that just hung out there about 40 feet away. And he was, they checked us out and they were off.
Mm.
And it was, I almost don't care if I ever go on another whale watch. That's such an incredible gift to see that. And accept that. Listen to how I talk about that. Okay, I've been to Disneyland, I don't need to see anything else. But, I was pretty cool. But just to have the evolution of our narrow picture of these animals is, still got a long way to go.
And this New York Times article, only this week, it ends with a story of a whale being caught in a net, and a group of fishermen try to extricate it, and working on different parts, and one guy was working on the mouth part, and he kept seeing the eye of the whale watching it, just watching. They finally managed to extricate the whale, and the whale just started going round and round and round their boat, just circling as if in joy. And then the whale went underneath the boat and lifted it very carefully.
Wow.
And then slowly, very carefully, dropped it down.
Oh,
and then out again. I mean, how do you like that? And they, the article tells of whales which they found, which were dead, which were on the shore. They did autopsies and checked of the brain, and they found the same configurations and the patterns of the brain in the cognitive side of the brain that you find in humans. I mean, how does that happen?
The same
configurations of the brain.
Yeah.
That you find in humans.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Divisions are inexhaustible. I vow to bring end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.